From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. Robin and Jeremy are off today. On this Memorial Day, President Obama laid a wreath at the Tomb of the Unknowns today at Arlington National Cemetery. It's a longstanding presidential tradition. And of course, next year, another president will have the honors. So let's start there with the race to succeed Obama. Bernie Sanders meets with voters in California today as that state and five other states prepare to vote next week. Bill and Hillary Clinton marched in the Memorial Day parade in Chappaqua, New York, where they live, while on Sunday, the investigation of Hillary Clinton's emails dominated conversation on the morning talk shows. And Donald Trump continued to draw crowds and consternation from some Republicans. Here he is at a Rolling Thunder motorcycle rally in Washington, D.C. yesterday.
Illegal immigrants are taking much care, really, are taking much better care by this country taken care of than our veterans. And that's not going to happen, okay? It's not going to happen.
Well, Ron Elving is NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent, and he joins us now. Hello, Ron.
Hi, Meghna.
So let's start with that assertion we just heard Donald Trump making, that undocumented immigrants are taken better care of in America than veterans. What's Trump up to there?
You know, there's a lot to complain about in the delivery of veterans' health care and other benefits. But to state the obvious, the government does provide care and education and housing benefits to veterans who are all entitled to the rights of citizenship, while undocumented immigrants have none of the above, live in limbo, face deportation and family breakup. So this comes after a week in which Donald Trump also went after the Latina governor of New Mexico, Susana Martinez, and after a federal judge in San Diego who has a Hispanic name and who happens to be handling a lawsuit against one of Donald Trump's failed businesses, the Trump University. So, you know, at times it appears that Donald Trump is trying to repeat the experience that California Republicans had with Proposition 187 and the devastating effects that it has had for the Republican Party there and taking those national.
But Ron, I mean, is any of this sticking to Trump, or is he continuing his streak of being the most Teflon-coated politician in recent American history?
For his hardcore supporters, that is unquestionably true. He does seem to have a Teflon coating, or you could go so far as to say that they heartily approve of many of the things that he says, even those things that we might expect to be damaging to a more conventional politician.
Well, let's move over to the other side then, to the Democrats. Hillary Clinton spoke with community activists in Oakland, California on Saturday.
I really think one of the best ways that I can be a good partner is to lift up what is working and lift up people who are trying to work together.
So Clinton there focusing again on her policy proposals, but it's her email problems that dominated the Sunday talk shows yesterday. Last week, a State Department audit faulted her for not following rules when she used a private home computer and private email address when she was Secretary of State. And then on CBS's Face the Nation, Bernie Sanders said it's an issue that voters need to consider.
It was not a good report for Secretary Clinton. That is something that the American people, Democrats and delegates are going to have to take a hard look at. But for me right now, I continue to focus on how we can rebuild a disappearing middle class.
So, Ron, what effect is the email issue having on Clinton that you're noticing?
You know, it's all over the media, as you say, Meghna, and as it should be. It is an issue. It's a serious issue, as everyone has agreed. It's been out there for a couple of years now and very widely discussed and very widely investigated, and it's finally coming to a head. How much it's going to matter to voters who have not made up their minds yet about Hillary Clinton is a little bit hard to say. It is going to be disqualifying for some voters, but most of them so far seem to be people who were unlikely to vote for her in the first place, and that could change. Of course, if the FBI investigation that's still going on finds that, in addition to breaking State Department rules, she actually broke the law.
I see. Well, let's talk for a moment before we wrap up here about the Libertarians, because they had their convention this past weekend. Former New Mexico Governor Gary Johnson won the Libertarian Party nomination, and former Massachusetts Governor William Weld won the nomination as vice president. Here's Weld on CNN this morning.
If we're a national party on the ballot in every state with a platform that is different from the two other parties' platforms, I would think it would be good for the country to have us in those debates.
So, Ron, how much of a factor might the Libertarians be?
The debates he's talking about, of course, are the debates with the two major candidates in the fall, and those would be on national television. And yes, it should be the best election yet for the Libertarian Party, and they could approach something like the effect that some of the big independents and third-party candidates have had in the past, but they'll need to be at 15% in the polls in order to get into those debates, in order to get a decent share of the vote in November.
Well, Ron Elving is NPR Senior Washington Editor and Correspondent. Thank you so much for joining us on this Monday, Ron.
Thank you, Meghna.
In Britain, the question of should the UK stay or should it go will be answered in the next month. On June 23rd, Britain votes on the so-called Brexit. That's the question of whether or not the UK should remain in or leave the European Union. Joining us now from London, BBC's political correspondent Rob Watson. Rob, welcome back to Here and Now.
Great to be with you.
So obviously there's some pretty heated argument over the possibility of a Brexit. Lots of people making different claims about what could happen if the UK left the European Union. I wonder if we could first start with the tale of economic peril that some people seem to be saying would face the UK. There was a new report out recently that said it could actually lead to more austerity in Great Britain.
You said it was heated. I'm surprised if you put your hands out the window in the United States, particularly on the East Coast, that you couldn't actually feel it. That's how heated it's getting. But absolutely, if we take the economic arguments, I mean, I think that has to be said. But if you look at all the various reports, and if you look at what the International Monetary Fund says, the Bank of England, most economists in Britain, they're all on the side very much of Remain. And then the latest one of those reports is from one of the few think tanks that people truly trust in the UK on all the political sides, called the Institute for Fiscal Studies. And they've basically said that the problem with leaving is that it would slow the economy down, and that might mean that austerity, government spending cuts, would have to continue for another couple of years.
And this is along the lines of the argument that those people who are for staying in the EU are making, that overall it would be of net negative economic impact to the UK.
Absolutely. But this is what people really need to understand about those arguing for Britain staying in the EU, because it might slightly surprise them. No one, David Cameron, who's the leader of the In campaign, the Remain campaign, he's not saying, we love the European Union, it's the best thing ever. Nobody is saying that. They're just saying, look, you know, whatever the EU's defects, we're stronger economically staying in the EU, we're stronger diplomatically, and we're stronger in terms of our security.
Well, on the other hand, there were also some new numbers out recently that seemed to speak to the yes to a Brexit campaign, because I was saying that the net migration to the UK in 2015, there were 333,000 people who arrived on the shores of Great Britain. That was almost near a record high.
Well, what the figures showed was that for years and years after the Second World War, where you had net migration from the European countries of, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10,000, it's stubbornly now, in terms of those coming from the EU, never mind those beyond, it's between 100 and 200,000. And obviously in a country Britain's size, I mean, you're talking about adding a city the size of Oxford, where I live every year, which is quite a lot. And of course, that has fed very much into the Brexit campaign, who have been saying, aha, this just shows you, if you really want to get control of your borders, control of immigration, you have to leave the EU, because obviously Britain's membership of the European Union means there's free trade and free movement of people.
So is that at the basis of the Brexit, the yes Brexit argument, that the only true way to regain sovereignty is to exit the European Union?
I mean, pretty much. It's slightly more difficult to sum up the Brexit campaign, but I mean, in the nutshell, they're saying, yes, if you want to take control of Britain's sovereignty, its destiny, its borders, where it's going in the world, and also if you want to decouple yourself, as they see it, from an EU that's a train crash waiting to happen, vote to leave.
Now, how is this roiling the UK's political classes? Because I see that London's new mayor, Sadiq Khan, is on the side of David Cameron to stay in the EU, whereas the former London mayor, Boris Johnson, is one of the most outspoken voices for exiting the EU.
And you can chuck something else in there, of course. David Cameron and Boris Johnson were at the same very elite school. So, I mean, the sort of psycho-political drama of it all is just unbelievable. I mean, I have to say, I thought this was going to get nasty because the stakes are so high, but I had no idea it was going to get this nasty. And it's partly, of course, because there's a sort of intra-party fight inside the Conservative Party. But it's also got nasty, partly because the two camps have started to see each other in an incredibly kind of negative, narrow way. So those who want to stay in the EU, I mean, they just think that people who would vote to leave, who would take the economic risk, are just barking mad. They're just nuts and crazy. Whereas those, the Brexiteers, tend to look at the others and say, you're so negative, oh my goodness, you've got no imagination, where's your daring, where's your British can-do? So, yeah, it's got really, really nasty, much nastier, I think, than even the politicians themselves could have imagined.
Could the upcoming vote and whatever the result is be a defining moment for Prime Minister David Cameron and his legacy?
Oh, absolutely. If Britain votes to leave, it'll be terminal. On the other hand, if we vote to remain, people will say, crikey, that David Cameron, we always underestimated him. He's won 2 referendums, 2 general elections. What a politician. I mean, I think if he does win, clearly it'll be extraordinary for his legacy.
Well, Rob Watson is the BBC's political correspondent. Always great to speak with you, Rob. Thank you so much.
You too, Magna. Thanks.
2 years ago, the United States received an influx of visitors from the north, the largest migration of snowy owls in decades. The Arctic birds usually only make it down to southern Canada, but in 2014, they got as far south as Florida. As NPR's Adam Cole reported then, scientists used the rare opportunity to tag the birds and follow their movements. We're going to listen back to that story, and then we'll bring Adam back into the studio for an update.
It's a chilly winter evening on the coast of Maryland, but naturalist Scott Weidensall and 2 volunteers are taking a walk on the beach. One of the volunteers cradles a pigeon.
We look like lunatics that have escaped the asylum here. He's taking his pet pigeon for a walk. I'm walking around with a giant mousetrap over my arm.
That giant mousetrap actually looks more like a hockey goal, a light frame that supports a loose netting. It's designed to harmlessly capture large birds of prey, and the pigeon is the bait. It will sit at the center of the trap wearing a sturdy leather jacket to protect it from piercing talons. A few hundred yards away, there's a bright patch of white perched on the crest of a dune, a large female snowy owl. Weidensall hopes she's hungry.
And that's kind of a typical, I'm getting ready to hunt perch.
He sets up the trap as stealthily as he can, and then he waits for the owl to strike. Like most birders, Weidensall was surprised when snowy owls suddenly started showing up in the United States, mostly in the north and the east, around Thanksgiving.
There was no preliminary. There were snowy owls everywhere. And actually, I got a call from Dave.
That's Dave Brinker, a biologist with the Maryland Department of Natural Resources.
Who said, this is obviously more than just the typical every 3 to 5 year eruption.
That's eruption with an I. It means a sudden increase in the abundance of a species. This snowy owl eruption wasn't caused by climate change. It was caused by lemmings. Owls eat lemmings, and Dave Brinker says when there are more lemmings, the owls have more babies.
When they get a big lemming high, they can lay up to 14 eggs, and that's what happened.
Huge numbers of owlets hatched, and come winter, they spread far to the south.
And that's when Scott and I got on the phone and said, we need to take advantage of this opportunity, because we won't see something like this for a long time, probably in the rest of our lifetime.
So Brinker and Weidensall launched Project Snowstorm. Their goal? To tag as many owls as possible with GPS transmitters. By studying the owls' movements, for example, the fact that they hang out at airports, the scientists hope to better understand their behavior and protect them from hazards. In less than 2 weeks, Project Snowstorm managed to cobble together a national team of volunteers and $20,000 in donations. Which brings us back to that Maryland beach, where Weidensall has been waiting for more than an hour.
Here she comes.
The big female owl launches herself at the trap, hovers above it for just a moment, and then flies back to her perch. After another half hour, she flies inland and out of sight.
After all that. And the next time somebody quotes Dave Brinker to me that anything worth doing is never easy, I'm going to hit him.
But further down the beach, another birder, Steve Huey, does manage to catch an owl.
It's very large. It's a female, pretty good size.
Like many members of Project Snowstorm, Huey isn't a professional ornithologist.
I'm an analyst for Marriott International.
But he is specially trained and permitted to catch owls. Huey and Brinker measure the big female's wingspan, tail length, fat stores, and then they take a blood sample. The owl is surprisingly calm, but every so often she voices her disapproval.
She says, oh, you got cold fingers.
And sometimes she shows her disapproval with her beak.
Ow! Man, that hurts.
Then comes the GPS transmitter. It's a small, light box that fits easily in the palm of your hand, and it's equipped with a solar panel and a chip that can hold 5 years' worth of data. The owl wears it like a backpack with two thin Teflon straps wrapping around her wings. Brinker carefully sews the straps by hand so they fit the owl's frame and don't interfere with flight.
At first, they're going to notice it, but they get used to it pretty quick.
As soon as the transmitter is snug, the owl is released on the beach where she was caught.
Are there any solemn words spoken on a time like this?
This is a high-tech owl, so we'll use Star Trek. Live long and prosper.
The owl takes off, gliding out into the dunes. Already her GPS unit is collecting data, longitude, latitude, and altitude, every half hour. And every 3 days, her transmitter and the transmitters of the other 15 owls tagged so far will connect to a cell phone network and send all their data back to Project Snowstorm.
We're all sitting there, 7 o'clock every third day. It's like, you know, come on, who's checking in? And look where that bird went.
You can follow all the tagged owls on the Project Snowstorm website.
Well, Project Snowstorm is currently following 14 owls, and we want to get an update on one of them now from Adam Cole, who reported that story for NPR Science. Hi, Adam.
Hi, Meghna.
So I'm excited to hear this update that you have to this story. I mean, I understand that you wanted to follow the path that one of the birds took when it migrated back north. So which bird did you choose?
Well, I chose to follow a young male, bright white, very handsome owl. His name was Baltimore because he was actually captured at an airport outside of Baltimore. And he's about 3 now. He was born in this eruption that piece was talking about.
So given that he was captured outside of an airport, I presume that means he was tagged in Maryland?
That's right. They tagged him and they brought him far away from the airport because airports are actually pretty dangerous places for owls. And they released him on a beach on Assateague Island. And then he took about 4, 5, 6 months to make his way up the coast and then up through Canada and finally reach the very top of Quebec.
Oh, so that's a long ways away mm-hmm. for him to travel. I mean, and because he's got this tag or transmitter, he's producing data the entire way up?
That's right. He checks in with his transmitter records his location, his latitude, longitude, altitude every 30 minutes. And then every 3 days, that data comes in to the scientists if he's near a cell tower.
Okay. So I'm just curious, given that we were able to tag at least these owls, I understand, mm-hmm. though, that we actually don't know all that much about them and their migratory habits?
That's right. These snowy owls live, they breed, they're born, they spend a lot of their lives up above the Arctic Circle. And that's a place where not a lot of humans are hanging out, so they're not very often observed. And so there's a lot we don't understand about their behavior.
Okay. But you were able to follow Baltimore's path. So how long did his migration take and what did you find?
Well, his migration took about 6 months. I took about a week to follow that path. and it was pretty fun because we were able to see not only some of the crazy places he stopped, like the top of a skyscraper in New York City, but we were able to use a website called eBird to look and see if anyone had seen him. This is a website where birders can upload their sightings. And so we were able to say, oh, Baltimore was in this place on this day. Did anyone see him? And while he was spent some time in New Jersey, we actually found a photo that someone had taken of him, and this person was a birder named Becky LeBoy.
It was very sunny that day. I came across this white bird body. As it turns out, it was Baltimore, just enjoying the sunshine, and I was enjoying watching him.
I love how she describes her encounter with him. I mean, mm-hmm. in the video that you produced, it seemed like everyone who did encounter Baltimore was really enthralled by the meeting.
Yeah, I mean, it's an amazing thing to discover one of these bright white birds totally away from any snow, just in your backyard. There was a woman that we met who worked at the smallest radio station in Canada, actually, and she had been a big birder all her life, but she'd recently had a hip injury, so she was sort of confined to her car, which made snowy owls the perfect bird to follow because they're very visible from far away. And she actually saw him on the top of her radio station, and sort of this owl became the radio station's sort of mascot for a time. So here she is.
I spotted the white owl on the very top of CJAI's silo. His mouth was open. You would swear he was laughing at us.
So when we visited that island, we checked the radio station. Baltimore wasn't there. So we went across the street to this school where some kids said they'd seen him.
We went outside and then the snowy owl was just like staring at us.
So that was pretty exciting for them. But he wasn't there either. So we had to drive around this island, which was about the size of Manhattan, but it had a population of 200 people. And we were searching for Baltimore on every perch we could find.
Wow. So not very good odds there. But for people who are listening who haven't yet seen your video, I know they've got just one question by this point in time. And here is a little bit from the video that helps answer that question.
Yeah, that's him. I can see the transmitter. I think that's him. I think that's Baltimore. Right there.
So you do find him.
Yes, at long last, we discovered him. And actually, it's pretty funny because I probably said that same thing about 12 times, and I was always wrong.
Oh,
it could have
no.
been a plastic bag. It could have been a mailbox. Sometimes it was an owl, but it wasn't the right owl. So actually confirming that it was him, seeing his transmitter actually on his back, was a pretty exciting feeling.
Adam, let me ask you, how really did that feel? I mean, you said excited, but I imagine that there was more deeper feeling, because every time I really think, like I look at a map and I think about the journey that these birds make under their own wing power, it astonishes me. And there you were. You made that same journey and then you found him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is amazing to think about not just the distance that they've traveled, but how many people he had encountered and touched, and how many people had seen him, and how many people hadn't seen him but unknowingly were his host. He stayed on houses throughout the United States and Canada, and those people never knew he was there, but they provided a place for him to rest. So definitely there was a feeling like I had discovered a celebrity. You know, at that point, he was loomed very large in my mind, and I finally got to see him.
Well, that must have been a terrific feeling. NPR science reporter Adam Cole, thank you so much, Adam. It's been great to talk with you.
Thank you.
By the time this Memorial Day weekend wraps up, around 38 million Americans will have traveled, according to AAA. Many will be spending some time tied up in traffic or waiting in those long airport security lines we've been hearing about. Now, that's an issue that's expected to come up at the meeting of the International Air Transport Association in Dublin later this week, where airline executives will discuss everything from the TSA and terrorism to climate change. Kurt Nikisch is senior editor at Harvard Business Review, and he joins us in the studio now. Hi, Kurt.
Hi, Meghna.
So first of all, about those long lines at airports, what are we expected to hear airlines executives say about this?
Well, they certainly know that it impacts them, those long lines, because the product that they sell, this airport flying experience, is all wrapped up in that. And so lately, U.S. airlines have been sort of, they've been telling their faithful flyers to show up early. They've been telling them to sign up for TSA PreCheck, which gives them access to those priority lanes at airports. They're sometimes paying for that for their high-value customers. But carriers are also working with the TSA more now to try to improve that. Delta has just announced new innovation lanes at the Atlanta Airport, and that's where instead of going into those security lines one by one where you take off your shoes and then you wait for the person in front of you to pull out their laptop, you kind of go in five at a time. Five, you sort of line up next to each other and everybody goes through the same thing at once. So Delta says this goes twice as fast, and Delta is actually paid to make the TSA go through with this.
Interesting. So we'll see how that works out. But let's turn now to the fact that the airline industry saw record profits last year, $33 billion. And of course, a lot of that had to do with those low fuel prices. So where do profits, ticket prices, and demand overall stand right now?
Yeah, so profits are expected to be up again this year, partly because a lot of airlines, even though oil prices have been low, some of them had locked in higher oil prices for certainty further back. So they're finally getting to the point where they can really enjoy lower prices. So even as they're ticking up, they're still benefiting. Demand is still high. Globally, passenger numbers are up. There's a lot of growth in Asia, in the Middle East. But flyers overall are paying less. Global fares are down about 4%. The average U.S. domestic fare has actually stayed steady. It hasn't risen in more than a year now, and it probably won't start rising until next year.
Oh, interesting. Those long-term contracts then explain why some people are still complaining that the prices haven't gone down even further, given those really rock-bottom oil prices.
Yeah.
But oil prices have been rising since January. I mean, if that continues, what does that mean for the airlines?
Yeah, that's a problem for the airlines, but they can cut back. They can start to gain more control over their fares by reducing reducing the number of flights that they fly. Delta has already said it's going to cut back some after Labor Day. In Europe, British Airways and Lufthansa have already started to scale back. And this means that basically if other airlines do this too, they wouldn't make as much money. They wouldn't be flying as much, but they'd make more on all of those planes because ticket prices would go up, and that would help compensate for higher oil prices.
Well, Kurt Nikisch is senior editor at Harvard Business Review, walking us through the ups and downs of airline ticket prices and profits as the International Air Transport Association meets in Dublin later this week. Kurt, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
We thought we'd take a few moments to revisit a little-known episode in American sports history. When you hear stories of Japanese Americans during the 1930s and 40s, the focus is often on the internment of over 120,000 citizens and legal residents by the U.S. government during World War II, or the mostly Japanese American 442nd Infantry Regiment, which fought in Europe and was the most decorated unit of its size in U.S. military history. But during that time, there was also the unlikely athletic accomplishments of a group of Japanese Americans who lived and worked on a sugarcane plantation on the Hawaiian island of Maui. That's the story Julie Checkaway tells in The Three-Year Swim Club, the untold story of Maui's sugar ditch kids and their quest for Olympic glory. The book comes out in paperback next month. We spoke to Julie Checkaway about it last October. I'm wondering if we could just start, literally at the beginning of this story, because we're talking about children of workers on the Pu'unene sugar plantation. Now, even though they're living in Hawaii, they weren't necessarily near the water and didn't have that much exposure to that part of what living in Hawaii means.
That's exactly right. Pu'unene is in the heart of the valley, of the valley isle that Maui is, where there's probably less than about 16 inches of rain, if that, per year. And the only access they had to water to cool off in were the irrigation ditches that snaked down from the mountains and rainforests of Maui to irrigate the sugarcane.
Now, these were children of Japanese immigrants. How long had those families been there?
Their parents had come over, most of them, at around the turn of the 20th century. The children, for the most part, were born in the 20s, and they were the children of field laborers. Some of the parents were mill workers.
Well, let's talk for a moment about a person who's really at the heart of this story, and that is Soichi Sakamoto. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about him?
He's one of the most important figures in modern swimming history. His parents were very traditional Japanese, and he fell into a life of teaching in the elementary school at Pu'unene Elementary. And he was not an athlete, nor was he certain of his destiny. He had a sense of himself as someone who was meant to do something important in life, something of value, but he didn't discover it until fairly into his 30s when he encountered the children, the same children he taught, swimming naked in the irrigation ditches. He saw them, and he saw the Luna, or the camp policeman, chasing the children out of the ditch. The ditches were forbidden because they were for irrigation. And when Soichi Sakamoto saw this, it touched some sense of justice in him. Mm-hmm. And he went to the plantation authorities, and he said, "Please let me oversee them in the ditch for 1 hour, after school each day." And the kids who I interviewed, now adults, said that in the beginning it was very free form. Coach Sakamoto, as they came to call him, would just stand upon the little walk bridge that went over the ditch and babysit them. Then one day, I've been able to pin it down to the fall of 1932, he looked at them and he said in an interview, he said he looked at the children and all of a sudden he didn't see them as labor camp kids. He saw them, he said, as bright gems bobbing in the sun. Hmm. And he brazenly called out, "How about I teach you something about swimming, eh?" And that's where it began.
Wow. And then when he goes on to form what he called the three-year swim club in 1937, that thing that he saw in those kids, he said, let's see how far we can take this. I mean, he said, work hard enough and maybe you can get to the Olympic Games in 1940.
He didn't even say maybe, Meghna. He said, we are going to the Olympic Games.
And that was in just 3 years, right?
I mean, yes. Yep, exactly. And we're going to do it in 3 years. We're going to swim every day. And, you know, it's quite rigid. And he wanted them to have the chance to get off the island, a chance for a college education. And sport was not generally something that Japanese Americans used as a means to rise and have upward mobility in the U.S. at that time. But there were reasons why he saw in them an opportunity for them to swim their way against the current of their circumstance, literally and figuratively, to the middle class.
At what point in time do the currents of history, I mean, we're talking pre-World War II here, start intruding on this project?
Very early in the process. The aim was to go to the 1940 Tokyo Olympics.
Right.
And as many people know, as early as 1938, Japan pulled out of the Tokyo Olympics for many reasons. And then Helsinki became the site for the Olympics for a period of time until war broke out in Europe, too. Mm. So what loomed was this vacuum. Was this hope inside that vacuum? Will we get a chance? Will we be still? Will the children, because they had become national champs within a year.
Right. So, I mean, that's actually something that that we should underscore here. They were successful. They were wildly successful. They went from being those kids in the irrigation ditch to some of them being national champions.
In 1938, some of the children traveled to Louisville, Kentucky, because they qualified for the men's national championships. And they performed remarkably, beating American champs, collegiate champs, kids from Yale. And so within 1 year, they were national champs. Within 2 years, they were beating all Olympic comers. And they became cause celebs. I mean, they were on the front page of every sports page in the United States and every major newspaper, including the New York Times, the Washington Post. These were big stories about these Hawaiian swimmers, as they came to be known, not
right.
Japanese American, because they became fashioned into Hawaiian swimmers.
Uh-huh. You know, we should note that some of the male members of the three-year swim club actually did serve in the United States military during World War II with the 442nd Infantry. So, I mean, they did their duty on the battlefield, even though they weren't allowed to swim on behalf of the United States. And you know, since the games had been canceled in 1940, well, what happens later, though? Because the Olympics were held eventually, at least in 1948. Were some of Sakamoto's swimmers there?
By all standards, they were old men.
Mm-hmm.
When they began to swim, they were in their teens, and their early 20s were spent in Europe fighting the Axis powers. When they came back, they had one last opportunity to go to the very first Olympics that was held after the war. The group that was left, and there was a core group of about eight, they went to the men's nationals of 1948, and there they competed for a spot on the men's team. And I'm not sure if I'm supposed to give this away, you know, what happens. It's a story of tremendous triumph.
Julie, as we wrap up here, I mean, I want to return to something that you said near the beginning of our conversation, which is that Soichi Sakamoto is one of the most transformative figures in the history of American swimming.
Mm-hmm.
How would you describe how great his contribution was?
From a sports perspective, he invented active and passive resistance training. He invented stroke technique. There was no coach at that time who focused on stroke and individuation of technique for each swimmer. Outside of sport, he was a man who saw that the American dream was available to immigrants of all kinds. I would argue that that's an example for us today at a time when we're talking, so having such violent discussions about American immigration.
Mm-hmm. It's been such a pleasure to speak with you, Julie. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
President Obama was at Arlington National Cemetery today, honoring members of the military who died while serving the country. Similar scenes are taking place at cemeteries across the nation and did so over the weekend as well. Here in Now's Alex Ashlock reports on an event at the Massachusetts National Cemetery on Cape Cod.
Hundreds of volunteers, some of them veterans of the Vietnam War, riding on their choppers, came to the cemetery Saturday morning. They were there to place American flags on the more than 60,000 graves.
If she can approach, she will give her a little flag.
You can go
so
get
it's very
own
special
flag.
If you can do that, okay?
Thank you.
This event is called Operation Flags for Vets. It was started by Paul Monty, a retired high school teacher who has a very personal connection to this place.
This is Memorial Day. This is a solemn day. Don't go up to a soldier today and say, hey, thank you for your service. That's not what it's all about today. It's about those friends, those buddies that he lost in battle in service to the country.
Paul Monty's son Jared was killed in action in Afghanistan in 2006. He died while trying to rescue a badly wounded fellow soldier, an act that earned him the Medal of Honor. It was awarded posthumously in 2009. Jared Monty is buried in Section 11, at the Massachusetts National Cemetery. His father placed a flag there on Saturday. For Here and Now, I'm Alex Ashlock.
If you've been out on the roads this holiday weekend, you might notice that it's getting harder and harder to find a toll booth with a human being actually collecting tolls. Toll plazas all over the country are going automatic. But just at the top of the Florida Keys, there's a toll booth where you'll always find people inside, at least for now. Jenny Luna was with the Miami Herald when she reported this story for Here and Now contributor WLRN in Miami.
If you're on your way to Key Largo in the Florida Keys, you can take US 1 or you can take Card Sound Road, a much longer, much quieter drive. Right where the road crosses Little Card Sound, you'll find the Card Sound Bridge, where drivers are greeted by a toll attendant waiting to take a dollar and say hello.
How are you guys doing?
Okay.
Okay, you guys have a great day.
You do the same.
John Struckman works the tolls. Some days are busier than others, like the peak days for lobster fishing in late July.
$1.
On a busy day, Struckman collects as much as $1,000 in tolls.
Yeah, so sometimes it's actually a little bit boring in between cars and stuff, but then I got my partner Bill here that I can pick on him on occasion.
Struckman shares the tiny toll booth with Bill Nemec. The toll booth's about 9 square feet, barely bigger than a standard office elevator. Nemec collects cash from the drivers leaving the mainland, and Struckman greets drivers coming from the Keys.
You get to see him for a few seconds every day.
Most commuters driving through live or work at Ocean Reef Club, the wealthy community just over the bridge.
I have a friend on the road with me.
Marianne Bigger is a property manager at Ocean Reef. She's been driving through this toll booth every morning and every night since she moved from the Keys to Homestead in 1988.
We know so much about each other, having had these 10 and 20 second snippets of conversation.
She knows that Bill loves bass fishing, that Johnny lives on a sailboat, and that another toll taker she calls Cowboy has a new grandchild.
It's turned into the whole history of the person that's standing there at the bridge toll. I know a lot of happy things that have occurred in their life, and I know some real tragedies.
Toll booth workers know they're a dying breed, and John Struckman can see down the road. His employer, Monroe County, has hired engineers to look into automating the toll booth.
When this job goes away, my alternative would be maybe a Walmart greeter, which I'm not really looking forward to.
folk singer Lori Jennings Udan wrote a song about the toll booth.
Driving down Cardstown Road, she's humming an old Beatles tune. Ooh, I need your love, babe, makes her think of him.
Jennings Udan lives in Homestead and goes to the toll booth whenever she's working at Ocean Reef. Her song's about a girl who falls in love with a toll collector.
I created they were fictional characters. I know the guys seem to think that I wrote it about each one of them, but that's not true.
But the song's about more than romance. Jennings doesn't care if an electronic toll booth will make traffic move more quickly across the bridge.
I will miss that sense of connection. That sense that, you know, you're not alone in this world, that other people are out there that want to share their life with you and you want to share your life with them, even if it's only in that little passing moment of the exchange of a dollar bill. And that's going to be gone.
Monroe County authorities say there's about 2 years left before the Cardstown toll booth goes automated. All 9 employees will be offered other jobs at the county. But a few say they'll just retire. For Here and Now, I'm Jenny Luna.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.